I call the House Committee on Healthcare together for Friday, February 27th, and open a work session on House Bill 2109 for the purpose of sending it to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs and whatever. Do we have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move, Mr. Chair Greenlick, I would like to move House Bill 2109 with a recommendation as to passage.
With no recommendation.
Without.
Without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, and then be further referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Okay. Representative Noss moves House Bill 2109. Without recommendation as to passage to the committee on to the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, with and further referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
I'll help you out since you helped me out.
I appreciate it. Every little bit helps. Is there any discussion on this motion? You know, the Speaker apparently would rather have it there than here. So we're trying to oblige by sending it there. Clem, we have a motion on the floor to move a bill to a different committee. That's all it does. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bueller?
Excuse.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kettimer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Excuse.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weiser?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Noss?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Motion carries. Wait a minute, hold on a minute before I close it. I'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2109 and allow Representative Kenny Geyer to vote on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The purpose of the motion is to move the bill to another committee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for being late, and I vote aye.
You weren't very late. You were almost on time.
Sorry.
That's good. The motion carries. Bill's on its way, and I will close the work session on 2109 and open a public hearing on the bill we carried over from the other day, House Bill 2605, and invite Representative Noss to introduce the bill to us, please.
It's weird to be on this side. Well, not really.
Can be both ways.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Noss. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland. And before I briefly discuss House Bill 2605, I want to thank all the stakeholders in this process that I've worked with for their time and diligence. That includes Insurance Commissioner Calley, Jeanette Holman, Doug Riggs, Peter Rico, Tom Holt, and many others who've been very generous with their time, and I appreciate their assistance. Over the course of many discussions with the co-op, the insurance division, and other health insurance companies, we came to several areas of consensus for changes that this bill is going to address. I'm going to let the experts discuss in detail what we're proposing, but I'm going to outline the background and context. So House Bill 2605 is a bill about the rate review process. And it arose from a situation in which Oregon's Healthcare Co-op, a member-owned health insurance company, had a disagreement with the insurance division over what the rate should be and what they would be able to charge for their plans, with the co-op feeling they ought to be able to charge less than the insurance division felt was appropriate. So this started a conversation in which the co-op and some other insurers articulated what they felt are changes that are needed to the insurance division rate review process to assist with transparency and reflect the realities of our current healthcare market, including the healthcare exchange. The co-op was particularly concerned that if they or another insurer submitted their rates to the insurance division and they had their rate disapproved, then they may have to functionally forego offering plans in the healthcare exchange in order to pursue an appeal of that rate. So my office drafted a bill, which you see in front of you, but we have since worked out amendments that we hope fit the needs of all the parties that are involved. Those amendments aren't in front of you or ready just yet, but we'll briefly describe them. One amendment would provide that if the insurance division disapproves or modifies the rate filing, the insurer would have the opportunity to meet with the division to discuss and respond to the preliminary decision. Another part of the amendment will allow an insurer to pursue an appeal, even if the division's even if they accept the division's initial rate. And this is especially important because it allows companies to participate in the exchange while still continuing conversations with the division or pursuing an administrative appeal on that rate. Currently, an insurance company which disagrees with the division's modifications to their filings may be functionally unable to participate in the exchange. And then lastly, the amendment will direct the insurance division to continue to meet with the stakeholders around issues where we weren't able to find consensus, and I'm going to let those experts speak to that in a little greater detail. There was also discussion of the possibility of an expedited appeals option, but I'm going to let the other testifiers talk about that in greater detail and to the bill in general. So this is going to be a good bill once you get the amendments, and those amendments are going to make it better, and I hope we'll pass it.
Does anybody have any questions as the witness? Thank you, Representative.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Jim almost got a chance.
He passed it, so you owe him one.
Ralph Prowse. Doug Riggs.
You want me to bring up Jesse O'Brien?
Sure.
And Jesse O'Brien.
I'll give my usual admonition. Take all the time you want, but not any more than you need.
All right.
Okay. Come on, somebody.
Me start.
All right. Thank you. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about this bill. My name is Ralph Prowse.
We have two vice chairs.
Oh, right, Representative Hayes. Thank you. Yes, I'm Ralph Prowse. I'm the CEO and president of Oregon's Health Co-op. Oregon's Health Co-op is a nonprofit health plan enabled under the Affordable Care Act. As Representative Nose indicated, it is a member-governed organization, so it is intended to provide direct access for the public to make changes and to create more affordable health care and better benefits for themselves. And I wanted to walk through with you, first of all, just a few things about this bill that speak to the manner in which it was created. And describe a little bit about the rate setting process as it has been. This slide here, and I realize that some of those lines don't show up very well, but that won't matter. This slide actually illustrates the 10 lowest priced silver plans on the exchange. And as you'll see on the left side, you'll see what the rates were for a 21-year-old non-smoker for the silver plan as they were filed. And on the right side, you'll see what the rates were when the insurance division finally approved them. And a couple of observations about this. First is that the insurance division didn't approve any of the filed rates as they were initially filed. They changed every single one of them. And so I don't know what to conclude from that, except that evidently none of the health plans had it right. All of them had it wrong. But the problem here, as I'll describe, is that there was no opportunity to find out what it was that the insurance division disagreed with about them. And in our case, as you'll see there, we filed two silver plans. One was priced at $154 a month, the other at $160 a month, about 20% or so lower than these plans had been the prior year. And the insurance division said that was too low, we'll let you lower them only 10%. And that's what led to our conversation with the insurance division because, of course, we're a consumer-run plan. We're really trying to scour every corner of the cupboard to come up with every bit of savings we could for these plans. We worked 10 months with actuaries from Milliman to do that and to come up with these rates that we felt were excellent rates, sustainable rates, fair rates based upon our medical costs, administrative costs, and other things. Filed them and then waited and found that they will not be acceptable. Now, the process as it exists right now is that these health plans do all that background actuarial work. They then file their rates. There's a period of questions by the insurance division, answers from the health plans, both in writing, and then there's a public hearing where the insurance division can ask questions in person and health plans respond in person, and then there's a short waiting period again where the insurance division comes to its final decision, and then the rates are made public in final form. And when our rates were increased like this, we asked the insurance division if we could get together to talk about it and figure out where our differences were. And at that point, we were informed that there really was no opportunity to do that. It's done. Then when we asked the question, well, is there some sort of an appeal process? What we learned at that point was, well, there's a contested rate hearing process. It has to be filed for an administrative hearing with an administrative law judge. And there won't be time to conclude that before your rates actually have to be launched. They have to be approved and launched on the exchange. So, in essence, it's not an option for you. Or you're out of business. I mean, that's really the only other option. You don't file the rates, you're not on the market, and you have nothing to offer. So it really was a false choice. And those are the key elements here that we're seeking to fix. And it is what led to the conversation with the division, a very constructive conversation, because I would say that we have exactly the same aligned purposes. I mean, the insurance division is all about the consumer, about protecting the consumer, about making sure that health plans are filing legitimate rates, fair rates, and so forth. And so it wasn't a situation where we were in disagreement that there should about the need for improving this rate-setting process. The question was, how are we going to do that? So at a high level, what really are the problems that need fixing here? Well, the first one is transparency. We all want better transparency. In this case, it's not that the insurance division didn't want to disclose its work that led to its decision. There just wasn't really an opportunity in the process to do that, and nor was there an opportunity for us to have a constructive dialogue with the division about its methodology, its actuarial assessments that led to their decision versus the ones that led to ours. So that leads to the second point on here. The process itself, as currently constructed, really isn't a due process that allows sufficient rate review bilaterally on both sides. And the insurance division is accountable for doing good work and coming to the right conclusions and having this process in place. But as it has been, it just hasn't worked that way. And finally, if you look at how each of those rates got changed, and in essence got changed by the division with no information about how they arrived at it, to conclude that, you know, we really don't have the fair, free marketplace that the Affordable Care Act envisioned. We have a contrived marketplace, and we don't yet really know how they get to those decisions. And this, once again, I want to emphasize, this is not a situation where the insurance division, I don't mean to imply that they've tried to withhold anything or not disclose it. There just was no opportunity to have that conversation. And to Commissioner Calley's credit and her staff's credit, they are more than willing to have the conversation. We just have to create a pathway in order for us to have that. So what specifically is missing in the rate setting process right now? Well, the process really doesn't provide that opportunity for the full disclosure of the work that the insurance division does to come up with its decision. It's like in your math class, you know, your math professor would not be satisfied if you just gave the answer. He or she would always say, well, yeah, show me your work. Well, that's what we're looking for in this bill. The second point, which I touched on, is that there is no opportunity currently for the public or for a health plan to actually have a conversation about the differences in opinion or the differences in the actuarial methods or assumptions that led to their various rate proposals. And finally, there is no opportunity, no practical opportunity right now for anybody who disagrees with that final decision to have a fair hearing, a due process, to have a second set of eyes and ears to review it. As I said before, a current process through the administrative law judge route doesn't get you there. That can take as long as 9 months to conclude, and you really only have about 30 days to get this thing done. So what does House Bill 2605 actually do to fix these things?
Are you talking about the amended version?
I'm talking about the amended version. There have been some important changes made to the one that you have before you. But the amended version, what it does is it provides the step in the rate-setting process for the insurance division to issue a preliminary rate. So how it would work under this bill is the health plans would file their documents and their rates. The insurance division would go through the same question-answer to get clarification on what has been filed. Then it would come up with a preliminary rate decision. And there would be a period of time after that preliminary decision where if a health plan or if someone, you know, a consumer chose to disagree, there would be an opportunity for that hearing to take place to have the conversation where the insurance division would disclose its work. We would have a hearing. We'd be able to actually have a dialogue about it. And after that, the insurance division would then file its or would come up with its final rate decision. After that final rate decision is made, this bill would then allow another opportunity, an opportunity to appeal it, and to do so in a very timely way. This bill would allow for the documents that have been filed to be reviewed by the director of DCBS to render a final decision about it. I want to add to this that the insurance division under this bill would not be compelled to do any new work or any work it hadn't already done in this process. The health plans wouldn't be doing any new work, any revisions of their work. This would be a matter of reviewing documents already done, taken to the director of DCBS for a last view. The bill doesn't remove or modify in any respect the avenue of the administrative law judge appeal. It's just that I can't imagine why anybody would want to go there because of the time it would take. But it would allow the health plan to accept the decision by the insurance division so that its rates could get onto the exchange at the level set by the division, pending any kind of appeal if they did decide to go through the administrative law judge route. So, in essence, this bill is really all about establishing a more transparent process, a better due process for everybody involved. It helps everyone. It harms no one. There aren't too many bills I could say, you know, that's true about, but this one I really don't
all
see.
All of my bills, I like that.
Of course. And so, in summary, I want to thank Representative Nose for helping to promote this. I want to thank the Insurance Division for its collaboration in constructing it. I'm looking forward to seeing the amended version as it comes out very soon, and I appreciate the support of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? This may be a good place to stop.
Timing question.
Yes.
Representative Greenick. Just a quick clarification and note that at least on OLS we don't have access to the amendments yet, but a question of timing. You testified that this process could take 9 months to go through or currently takes 9 months to go through, yet this is requesting that the information be filed 8 months before the open enrollment period. So how does that line up?
It doesn't, in fact. And the timing of the bill, as you see it now, has been removed from the amended version. The timing of this is very exquisitely sensitive. There are many moving parts, some of which are out of the control of the insurance division or health plans or anybody else. They're in the hands of the federal government. So we agree that should be removed and has been removed from the amended version. The 9 months I was referring to, though, actually was a reference to the time it would take to go through the administrative law judge appeal if a plan today disagreed with the decision by the insurance division. It takes a very long time, way too long, so it's an ineffective and impractical solution.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Riggs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for record, Doug Riggs on behalf of Oregon's Health Co-op. I'm just going to be brief. I think Ralph has summarized the bill fairly well, but let me make three quick points. The first is this is something that sounds like a very complicated situation and process, and it's taken us a while to get to an understanding of the insurance division, but really it boils down to common sense. It creates a system where the timing is such that it allows for an actual dialogue to take place, and that's important. The second thing, and I do want to say this in regards to some of the testimony that was posted online, understandable given the nature of the original bill. The objections, and I've read through the testimony that was submitted by Moda Health, both of those objections are removed from the amendment. So I think that we'd address Moda Health's concern. One of those being the question about the timing, the 8-month element in the original bill has been removed. And then the second was a question about the range of rates, which Representative Nose and his great staff, Ethan, and the group worked on for several weeks. We decided it was very complicated and not something we could reach an agreement on by the time this hearing came around. So what we hope the amendment will do is punt that to a stakeholder discussion during the interim that would include us and Osberg and the insurance companies and the insurance division as well. So range of rates is the second issue that was on some of that testimony, and that's also out of the bill. And then the third thing I want to say is there have been a lot of people at the table. I want to echo what Ralph said, thanking the representative and his staff. The insurance division and I and the group have met probably 7 or 8 times directly, and we've probably had 35 emails flying back and forth. So this really is a great example of a collaborative process, and we appreciate the input that other stakeholders have had as well. So we think it's ready for prime time. We think it'll make a difference in creating a more transparent process and one that's better for consumers, and we hope that we'll get an amendment back that we can actually take a look at in the next few days.
When's the amendment coming?
I think that legislative counsel, Mr. Chairman, has said within a week, so we're hoping to have something back by Wednesday that we can take a look at before the Friday hearing or Friday work session.
So, Brian?
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer group. As many of you know, OSPIRG has been involved with Oregon's health insurance rate review process for some time, and we initially had some pretty serious concerns about the placeholder language for HB 2605, but we've really appreciated the ongoing discussions of all of these issues that we've had with the insurance division, with the co-op, and with Representative Nose. And we are optimistic that all of our concerns will be worked out in consensus amendments that are currently in the works. To give a little bit of background, although it's not perfect by any means, and OSPIRG will continue to recommend policy changes to improve it, Oregon's rate review program is really delivering for consumers, and it is widely considered a national model. Advocates from other states come to me and ask how they can get a rate review process that works anywhere near this well in their state. Since stronger rate review rules were put in place starting in 2010, we estimate that Oregon's rate review program has cut about $179 million in waste and unjustified costs from premiums for individuals and small businesses in Oregon. And it's also made contributions that are measurable to building a more efficient health insurance industry in the state. In 2011, as many of you know, the insurance division created a formal process for a consumer organization to analyze and comment on rate filings from a consumer perspective, supported by a grant of federal funds. And OSPIRG Foundation, our 501c3 sister organization, has been the contracted organization in that program since 2011, which has given us a front row seat over the past several years. We believe that Oregon's existing process is working well, so we are inclined to be very reluctant to support major statutory changes to the process. However, we do recognize the problems that Oregon's Health Co-op has raised with the existing appeals process, for instance, are very legitimate. The process is exceedingly lengthy and does not work for plans to get their rates approved for the exchange, which is a real problem. And we're happy to support statutory changes to address those problems. We're also happy always to support any efforts to increase transparency and foster more productive dialogue between insurance insurers, regulators, and the public. However, we would ask that the committee consider the following concerns as you work toward developing amendments. First of all, the insurance division has already made some administrative changes to the process in response to some of these issues as they were brought up around the end of the rate review process last year, including providing insurers with the plan is this year to provide insurers with a proposed rate decision in advance and enable more dialogue once that proposed rate decision has been put out there, and we're supportive of that. However, we would urge caution before enshrining these changes in statute at this point. Oregon has not yet gone through a rate review process using this new model, and we don't know yet whether it will work as intended. And the reason that I'm concerned about this is that without adequate safeguards, this kind of process could supplant the existing process and change the incentives for participating insurance companies in a problematic way. So if, for example, the process was set up so that every insurer attempted to appeal the proposed decision every time, that could cause problems. It could also reduce the incentive for insurers to provide all the information necessary to justify their proposed rate when they file initially. And Osberg has been concerned for years about the amount of information that was made available in initial filings. We don't want to take away the incentive for carriers to be upfront when they file their proposed rates in the beginning. We think that the administrative changes are fine. We're happy to support them this year, but we want to see how they go. And, you know, we'll do what we can to watchdog the process, but we don't want to set anything in stone at this point if we can avoid it.
And you're opposed to the bill?
No. We're concerned. I mean, if
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
What I'm saying is
We'll put some things in statute.
Right. And we're happy with changing the appeals process. We're happy with that part of the bill and the agreed-upon amendments. The concern that I'm raising, and I haven't seen the proposed amendments, is if the proposed amendments enshrine these administrative changes that have been made into statute in an inflexible sort of way, then that could cause a problem. But we haven't seen the language in the amendments, so we don't have a position
again,
on that yet.
Idea.
But you will hear from me again after we have a chance to review the amendments. And also just wanted to say in closing, we absolutely sympathize with Oregon's health co-op in their desire to keep their rates as low as possible. A consumer organization could only be sympathetic to those aims, but it's really important that we make sure that we maintain the integrity of this process, because right now the question is, can an insurance company lower their rates as much as they want? But the next time, it might be a very different question. So we want to make sure that the process itself maintains its integrity. And I also just want to make sure that I state for the record that we don't have a position on what exactly happened with Oregon Health Co-op's rate. We didn't weigh in and do an in-depth analysis on that rate because, as hopefully you will understand, we tend to focus on increases because those are the source of concern for consumers. But it can be a legitimate role of rate review to create a rate that is higher than the rate requested by an insurance company. Like I said, I don't know whether this was one of those situations or not, but a rate needs to be sustainable. And if a rate is too low, it could lead to an insurance company going under or having to have a very large rate increase in the following year, which could be very disruptive for consumers. And again, I don't know whether this was really one of those situations, but that is a legitimate role for the rate review process. So thank you. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Okay.
Mr. Prowse.
Oh, yes.
He made a comment he wanted to make.
Well, we need
a brief comment.
Brief comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to say I agree with Osberg's concerns. But I want to make it clear there's nothing in this bill that should be construed to change in any way the requirements of the insurance division or of the health plans with regards to the information they submit now to support their rates, or to change the scrutiny that those submissions undergo by the insurance division. Nothing in here changes in that regard. So the same level of detail, the same, exhaustive actuarial support.
One time. We can
Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
brief question, brief, Chair Greenlee. You mentioned $179 million in premium savings. The slide I saw there, I know that's not representative of everything. 90% of those actually went up through the rate review process. Does the $179 in savings include federal subsidies or not, that calculation?
Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden, that calculation does not include the tax credits. That calculation is based purely on the difference between the rate that was proposed and the rate that was approved by the division.
In the entirety of the rates?
Right. And it's an estimate. It's hard to predict the exact impact, but
it on mine.
Okay, would you please call the next panel?
Sure.
Three from DCBS, I think.
Yes. T.K. Keene, Jeanette Holman, and Annette Boyce.
And one witness after this. Is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlee and members of the committee. My name is T.K. Keene, and I'm the Acting Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division. Along with me today is Annette Boyce, the Product Regulation Manager of the division, and Jeanette Holman, one of our policy analysts with the division. Unfortunately, Commissioner Callie is traveling out of state today and is unable to join us. So in her place...
Some people will do anything to avoid Tesla.
In front of us a lot, though, I think. Especially on tough bills.
So we're here to speak with you about 2605, and the division's focus throughout this process with stakeholders has really been focused on trying to maintain the transparency of the rate review process, maintaining our or improving the opportunity for public participation in the process, and protecting the integrity of the filing process to prevent any kind of gaming or any advantage that someone might have by filing an appeal. In short, our aim has been to provide a process that continues to protect consumers. I would also note that we believe many of these items that are in the bill, we actually have the authority to change by rule or by changing some of the directions we give as part of the filing process, with the exception of the appeals process.
Are you referring to the amendment?
I'm sorry. Yes, I am referring to the amended version.
Good.
So thank you. Thank you for that clarification. So I think it would be helpful at this juncture to give the committee a general overview of the rate filing process and highlight some of the issues that we're working with stakeholders on the proposed bill.
We make that very brief because
yes,
we would like to do that in a general context, but if it would be very helpful if you commented on this bill particularly.
Okay. We can make that very, very brief for you. To give that overview, I will go ahead and allow
that. I've asked Commissioner Kelly to brief us on the whole issue.
Okay, but can do that.
So we do want that, but this isn't exactly the time for that.
Understood. So Annette can give a brief overview of that process, and I will turn it over to her for a few minutes.
Good afternoon, Annette Boyce, the Insurance Division, Chair Greenlee, and members of the committee. The Insurance Division reviews rates for individual and small employer health plans to ensure that they're actuarially sound and that rates are adequate to cover costs and not excessive. We focus on protecting consumers, and transparency and public involvement is a really high priority in the review process. The process is established by rule. We generally have about 2 months to complete all of the work, including public hearings. The process is aligned with federal requirements under the Affordable Care Act, and insurers submit rate filings in accordance with administrative rules that require all the particular elements to be filed with the filing, and all the information in the filing should justify what they're requesting. So everything should be filed at the outset that justifies their rate request. And virtually all this information is available for public review in real time. A public comment period opens anywhere from 1 to 10 days after we receive the filing. It's open for a minimum of 30 days, generally longer than that. Osberg talked about their involvement in our rate review process, and so they are doing their review along with ours. Division actuaries and analysts conduct a detailed analysis of each filing. We ask questions, get explanations. All of that, again, is available on the website for people to review as we're going through that process. We did have this situation at the end of the rate review process this last year where we realized there wasn't really a lot of good discussion before we made a final decision. So we met with each of the carriers and consumer groups and have made some administrative changes to the process that we'll use this year that have been mentioned. We will be doing a preliminary decision. After the preliminary decision, carriers will be able to review that, and then we will have a public hearing on every single filing. So every filing will have a public hearing after we've made our preliminary decision. And then we take public comments and the information provided in the public hearing back to make a final rate decision. And then that final rate decision, the carrier will be notified of what that decision is along with their appeal right. Under the current law, without anything that this bill provides, that would be the regular Administrative Procedures Act process that's lengthy. If this bill passes, then those appeal rights would include whatever the bill includes in there. So,
Chair Greenlich, just to quickly highlight for you three things that we're keeping an eye on and working with stakeholders on. As others have mentioned, recognizing that the timelines of the ACA somewhat rein us in as far as how much change we can actually do, how much, if there would be, through an amendment process, any kind of actuarial calculations that would be new or any kind of documents that would be required to be produced that we don't do now. We have limitations in terms of staff and timing on that. The second would be any changes to the appeals process. We would want to make sure that in that there would be time for a fair appeals process that would not in some way create confusion about what the actual rates would be at the end of the day pending an appeal, and also ensure that there wouldn't be any competitive advantage that could be incurred by opting to do an appeal with carriers in a way that could be harmful to consumers. And finally, range of rates provision would be harmful to us, would not be harmful to us. I'm going to amend what I just said there. It would be something we need to take a look at further because of the actuarial work that we do. And then there's a lot of stuff that goes into our decisions that is not necessarily actuarial in nature. I can talk about that further if you'd like.
I could add my amendment to this bill to have you do the medical trend in advance rather than. I'm just saying, I think how that bill would be a perfect vehicle.
Something easier.
So we will continue on these issues to dialogue with stakeholders, and once we see the amendments, we'll be able to provide some more feedback and comments. And with that, I think I'll take any questions that you all might have.
Thank you. All right. You're going to testify?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm Jeanette Holman, Senior Policy Analyst for the Insurance Division, and I'm just here to field the easy questions. So if you have easy questions, I'll talk to you.
The hard questions have to wait till Commissioner Kelly comes back. Right, I understand. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, and we will have a briefing. I have also suggested that she bring maybe last year's insurance book to look at to see the report. I think it's very important for us to have a firm understanding of what goes on. Thank you very much. Would you call the last witness, please?
Elizabeth Hamley.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Cambia, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I feel like I'm making it a habit of being here on Fridays and being the last one to testify.
You're just trying to ruin your weekend.
Sorry.
It's not bad.
So I'm here today to offer my thanks to Representative Nose and the co-op for working with us to come up with some amendments that we can agree with. We haven't seen the amendments yet, so we can't speak to them, but the conceptually we think that they make the bill a whole lot better, and so we really appreciate the work that we're doing, and Cambia supports that effort, and we're looking forward to seeing the amendments. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
I look forward to seeing them too.
Yeah, you want to comment?
No.
I don't wish to close. I yield my time.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2605 and open an informational hearing and call. Chris Alaric in to talk to us about the whole question of tax credits for to encourage various aspects of the healthcare system. And then we'll have three bills that we'll open as well, Chris. Thank you very much for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alaric, the Legislative Revenue Office. And I was asked just to give a brief overview of the tax credit review process. I think a number of the members have heard this in other committees, but not everybody. So briefly, just history. In 2009, the legislature put sunset dates on just about every tax credit. There were about 60 or so at the time, and put them on a rotating cycle so that every 2 years, one-third of them would be reviewed. So in 2011 and 2013, the first two batches went through a review process, and here in 2015, it's the third batch.
They were reviewed against the budget, which is the...
Correct, Mr. Chair.
I think that's the thing that made them different is the Ways and Means process established a budget, or the revenue established a budget, and then they were reviewed against that budget.
Correct. There was a joint committee on tax credits that was created, and it was a budgetary process. And so one of the changes this time... In 2013, House Bill 2002 was passed that required your Legislative Revenue Office to produce a report on the tax credits that are sunsetting in the biennium. And so that, I believe that that report has been shared with you, or at least excerpts of it, the relevant ones for the two credits before you today. The report itself was released to the Revenue Committees a couple of weeks ago. And that goes through all of the tax credits that are sunsetting this session and talks about a policy purpose, a description of the mechanics of the tax credit, and then tries to get at a policy analysis of the tax credit. It might be the case that more questions are posed than answered in the report, but it's really trying to move that along in terms of a policy analysis to evaluate whether or not the tax credits are doing what the legislature wants them to do. Also included in the report is some information on similar credits in other states and an attempt at getting at some of the administrative costs of some of the tax credits. I would say I would consider the report a work in progress, just in that there's always new information that can be added to the report. And then part of House Bill 2002 was an additional staff person in LRO. And so this session I am... I'm available to all the policy committees to the extent that you would like my assistance in the evaluation process of the tax credits. And that could be in whatever manner the chair and the members would like in terms of gathering additional information or tracking down whatever policy questions or answers the committee deems necessary. The overarching theme of it in terms of evaluating any tax credit would be a focus on a policy purpose. And generally speaking, statute does not identify the policy purpose for given tax credits. So even just being as clear as possible about what the goal is of a tax credit moves the legislature in the right path toward a more complete analysis of those tax credits. And so that's my 3-minute Cliff Notes overview.
Well, that's very important, and we'd very much like your help on this, although I think maybe the process to see now is that we make some comments on the policy issues and then send it over to the Joint Committee or to the Revenue Committee, but I think usually to the Joint Committee to put in that package. We would like ours to fit into the budget along with everything else. We have both tax credits and loan repayment programs, which are intended to do very much the same thing. Is there a way to compare them and to put them in the same framework, or do we have to think of those as completely different issues?
Chair Greenlick, I think that's part of the intent of having the policy committees go through it. The report does include at least an initial cut at direct spending programs that appear to be similar to the tax credits. It is not a comprehensive list of direct spending programs, but it's meant to be a step in that direction. And there are, for one of the credits, exactly as you said, there are some loan repayment programs. And so our understanding from leadership is that part of the intent of having this review in the policy committees is to say, well, we have this direct spending program, whatever that form is, and this tax credit. So you have an indirect spending and a direct spending program. And to what extent do they complement each other or serve different constituencies? How do they relate together? Do they overlap a great deal? Is there minimal overlap? Those kinds of questions, because it just comes down to direct spending or indirect spending to support those public policies.
Well, our major programs, as we've seen them, are to do two things. Well, they're all to get providers to behave differently. And one set of them is to get them to move out in the rural areas and keep serving, and the other set is to get them to pick specialties that are needed, like primary care. That's basic. If they simulate primary care, or they simulate getting somebody into John Day. Do you have any sense, or is there any way to ask the question, is a loan repayment program more effective than a tax credit program to do the same thing? Because I think it's a toss-up here.
Yeah, my experience and expertise is more on the tax side, not on the direct spending side. So I'm still going through a learning curve on the direct spending side. But I think the goal is to get as complete an answer as possible to that question. And if it's a toss-up, what are the advantages and disadvantages of concentrating resources on the direct spending side versus the indirect spending side? Because if it's a toss-up, maybe one replaces the other, or maybe there's value for both of them. And it's really that kind of analysis, at least to the extent it could be done during a session, would occur. And again, it would be an ongoing, that's why the tax credits have sunsets on them. It could be an ongoing process.
By toss-up, I mean we don't know which one is effective either. We don't mean they're equally effective, at least I did. There's some questions like this. There is a bill somewhere, I understand, to try and put them all in the same. I think Representative Nathanson has a bill. To put them under some policy control.
The brief experience so far in 2011 and 2013 was a tax credit omnibus bill. And as I think the members are aware, this time around, a simple extension of the 18 tax credits would cost an estimated $64 million for the 15-17 biennium. And the budget that the Revenue Committee chairs and the Joint Committee on Tax Credits is simply the two revenue committees, is a $14 million budget. So there's a $50 million difference between the spend and the ask, if I'm using that terminology correctly. And I believe the revenue committees are looking at ways to raise some revenue to spend in a bill so that within the same bill there would be some revenue-raising pieces to spend on the extension of the tax credits. Now, one of the hopes from the policy on behalf of the JTAX for the policy committees is for whichever credits you feel are worth considering and sending down to JTAX, there might be different policy levels that could be sort of supported at different levels of funding. So that, in some sense, it would mirror the Ways and Means process where, depending on the budget that JTAX ultimately has between the $14 million and whatever they could raise and all of the tax credits that make it down to that committee, they could fit them all under the same budget.
Will we automatically have all of the health ones before us of the ones that are expiring? I mean, here we have one in front of us. Should we do this? Well, yeah, we should do this compared to something we don't have in front of us.
Chair Greenlink, there is a matter of opinion in terms of where they would fit. The one that you just sent down is a health care bill, but it focuses on veterans. So that's going down to the Veterans Committee.
Right.
So there is that take on which is the appropriate committee. Some tax credits serve almost identical purposes, and in other committees, those are there, and other committees are having that discussion about they have two tax credits that do the same thing. Here in the report that I structured, I think I put five or six under the category of health care. But two of those in that group were the two veterans ones. There's a different one than the one that you sent down. And I believe one of those, the Veterans Committee, already passed down to JTAX.
Well, we'll just change everything. You can figure it out. Representative Bueller first, and then Representative Nose.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So I want to make sure I have it right. So we've spent millions and millions on tax credits, but haven't had defined evaluation criteria if they're meeting their stated objectives.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Bueller, if I go back a little further for history here, in 1995, the legislature required the governor and the Department of Revenue to produce a tax expenditure report. And they required a great deal of information in that report. And so the first report was presented to the 1997 legislature. It was in conjunction with the governor's recommended budget. And part of that report included an evaluation. So one of the sticking points with one of the challenges with any evaluation of the tax expenditures, and this is for all tax expenditures, and there are about 350 of them in statute, is who is the appropriate person or body or entity to do that evaluation. In the tax expenditure report, it was the state agencies that have a broad program objective deemed to be similar to the presumed policy purpose of the tax credit or the tax expenditure. And over time, since 1995, one of the frequent criticisms of that report is that the evaluations had not been rigorous enough, might be a way to phrase it. So there was some acknowledgement about the need for an evaluation. The state agencies were doing an evaluation from 1995 and it's still part of the report, so that report still gets produced. And the most recent version was handed out at the beginning of this session. And I think there's been an evolution of that process beginning in 2009, putting sunset dates on all the tax credits, again, focusing on the tax credits because that's a small enough number of tax expenditures to deal with, and they are limited to Oregon tax law.
Follow up, please. So I'm still not...
That's a very interesting report if you haven't had a chance.
It is.
It's this thick or something like that. About $30 billion a biennium, if I remember correctly. Is that
so? For example, can you tell me if the rural provider tax credit has been effective in accomplishing the goal?
At this point, I can't answer that question definitively.
Why?
I haven't done an analysis of it. And
I thought you said there is a report that is available. Maybe I misunderstood.
Well, there's an evaluation there provided by. I believe the Office of Rural Health on that particular one. And I believe they're here, and then they might be able to answer that question better than I can.
We'll hear from them in a bit. Okay. It's not been very rigorous. Representative Nose?
Never mind. My point's been made.
Representative Lively?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as we're having this conversation, and I can appreciate this analysis, evaluation done on the individual tax credits, but obviously over time, even if we might argue that it's effective, it may not be the best use. So from a policy standpoint, I'm trying to understand, is there any, in this policy discussion, is there anything about the total and whether the value, regardless of if it's working or not, the value in the big scheme of things is where we're going to be today versus 10 years ago or wherever it was that we started this?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Lively, I think that's part of the intent to ultimately get there, and it's going one step at a time. And one of the pieces in this report that was just produced this session was at least moving toward a comparison of direct spending and indirect spending. So it's really a step toward that. Ultimately, that's the long-term goal, is a very broad view of all of the spending to support a purpose.
Thank you.
Hayden?
Chair Greenlee, do we have a sense at all, looking at this from a slightly different angle, if you have the total $64 million that I'm hearing that we're spending on this, of the people that take advantage of that tax credit, what is the revenue from those individuals in taxes to the state? What's the cash flow in under the assumption that maybe they came to Oregon because of that and might not have been here otherwise? Do we compare that at all?
Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden, not specifically, but it is certainly something we could look at incorporating and the extent to which that fits in with an analysis. For all of the tax credits that exist, they have different broad purposes. Some of them are intended as an economic development tool. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are intended to affect behavior one way or the other. And some of them are a method of financial assistance. And so depending on the flavor of the tax credit, some of the information may be more on point than others. But we can certainly try to incorporate that.
You're asking for the question of the people who got a tax credit, how much income tax did they pay?
Right.
This credit was a subtraction from
it. Yeah. As a follow-up, in human services and housing for subsidies and tax credits for child care, that question might not really fit into the policy of what we're trying to accomplish.
Correct.
But under health care, it might be a relevant question to how much came in or how much did they contribute, those individuals, to the tax system because that credit was there, where I think that might be pertinent to the conversation.
And the question is, it might be the other way, right? I mean, it might be a high-income person who gets a $2,000 tax credit, it's ho-hum. A low-income person gets a $2,000 tax credit. That might actually get them to go to John Day.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It could be one way or the other. It's really, this is, I think we're moving in a way to get more information about this. I think anything, the more we can get, I think the better it is. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think when we're looking at these, because I kind of thought that was factored in, following up on what Representative Hayden just said, because it's like I have a bill that's a tax credit for, say, it could be a device, 3D printing. I dropped it last time, this time. We don't have 3D printer manufacturers here, so it doesn't cost us anything to do that, because if we could get the manufacturer to locate here and they have 100 employees, that's a net positive for the state, to where the credit doesn't really matter if, say, they had it for 10 years because we weren't receiving anything from them and we're not taking anything out of the system. Would that be correct?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Weiner, that's a good point. And part of the, not to stray too far from the tax credits per se, but part, the core function of the Legislative Revenue Office is the revenue impact statement for every bill. And that has been limited to the direct impacts of a tax credit. And I think what you're referring to are some of the indirect or dynamic impacts. And over the years, we have, the office has added tools to try and get at some of those dynamic impacts. And that discussion continues. From a broad perspective, whether we're talking about tax reform and what that might do, down to individual policies. And all of this is an intent to try and move down that road to provide a more complete picture of the potential impacts of a given policy.
I know my personal policy is to vote against any tax credit that doesn't have an offset, but because except inside the budget. I mean, I think that's the major advantage. We said, here's how much money we have to spend on tax credits now. What's the best way to spend that money? That's a very different question than, is this a good tax credit?
And I guess I would add, in 2011 and 2013, in each of those sessions, we've seen the gamut of the tax credits. Some tax credits have been allowed to sunset. Some tax credits have been modified to reduce the revenue impact. One significant tax credit was divided into four different tax credits, largely because of the policy purposes. It had gotten so big and it was serving so many policy purposes, it was really confusing and challenging to understand if it was doing what it was intended to do. So it was broken across policy purposes. And one tax credit was, the sunset date was moved forward, and the revenue savings from that was put to a direct spending program. So in 2011 and 2013, there was kind of a gamut of policy changes, primarily made by the Joint Tax Credit Committee in those times.
Good. Well, thank you very much. We need to make sure that everybody has another look at those components of this report that relate to the health side, so we have a chance to see that. Chris, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Close the informational hearing.
Rep Wilson's not here yet. Do you want to go into this one? There's only one person.
Okay, let's go with that one. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2110 and ask the senior Mr. Powell to join us.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this extends the corporate tax offset of insurer assessment to January 1, 2022.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and the standard. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a different form of a tax credit that you're used to seeing. Most tax credits are on an ongoing basis and based on either the production of a good or a widget or a service that the legislature has seen fit to try to promote. This tax credit is different. It only arises if there is an insolvency of an insurance company in which the other insurance companies that write that line of business have to assess each other and pay the claims that that insurance company, which is now insolvent and unable to pay claims. So it only would be used in a time when there is an insurance insolvency of some size. The tax credit takes place in order to protect the revenues of the state of Oregon over a five-year period, instead of saying if your company had to put out $1 million this year, they don't get $1 million of credit in the next year. They get 20% of what they paid out in each of the next 5 years. So it's a little convoluted in that way. This particular credit only applies to life and health type policies, including annuities. It doesn't include property and casualty companies. That system is in a different statute and does exist, but it doesn't use a tax credit. It uses a direct assessment against the policyholders throughout the state of Oregon. So if a property and casualty company becomes insolvent, the homeowners company that has a lot of homeowners lines, then everybody that has a homeowners policy in Oregon in the next year will have a little assessment on their policy to pay the claims of the people who were insured by an insolvent company. So that's the system that's been in place for a long time. I think most states have this kind of a tax credit system attached to a guarantee association.
Explain again how it ends. If an insurance company is assessed a portion of the claims of an insurance company that's going out of business, and it has all of that assessment, comes back to them as, assuming they make a profit,
yes,
comes back to them as a tax credit off their insurance bill in the state of Oregon.
Off their tax bill.
Tax bill. Tax.
But only 20% of it a year over 5 years. Again, primarily trying to protect the revenues, the revenue flow to the state of Oregon.
So it essentially, if an insurance company goes bankrupt, the state of Oregon pick up the claims costs. Right?
Mr. Chairman, in essence, if those companies made a profit, who stepped up and paid those claims, yes, that would be true.
So we could just pay them directly rather than, and we could create a pool in the state.
Mr. Chairman, you could, and this is an indirect way of doing that. The insurance companies assess themselves for all the administrative costs. These guarantee associations exist. They're dormant for the most part, but they do have some expenditures that they make on an ongoing basis in order to do their administrative work. And they usually have a lawyer involved and that sort of thing in case there is an insolvency.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
No, I was asking for more clarification as you just did. Thank you.
Many times in an insolvency, another company will buy the company. In health insurance, that's usually always the case. The major health insurers in Oregon are not susceptible to this kind of insolvency because their contracts, if they're a health service contractor, they have contracts with their medical providers not to go back against the patient if they're unable to pay their claims. So in most cases, I'm sure to the case with Kaiser, with Blue Cross, I know, the providers have agreed through contract not to go after the patient if the insurance company folds.
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlee, just clarify for me, doesn't the insurance commission require restricted reserve put into place by these insurance companies in order for them to get licensure, so in case of insolvency that they can draw on that restricted reserve, which the insurance commission has to give authority to draw? Are you talking about cases that exceed that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, yes. And the first thing...
Very rare, right?
Yeah, it's very rare. The first thing they do is use the monies that are on deposit, and then any other assets that they can glean from the insolvent company, and they go after those assets, pool them, use that money first, and then assess themselves to pay the claims that are left.
Yep. Follow up.
Yeah, I don't think this has happened in the last decade. It has happened in Oregon.
It has happened, but it's been a some time, yeah.
So it's not an issue of reassessing the formula that's out there that assesses the need for the restricted reserve. You're comfortable with that formula?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, yes, I think the amount that the insurance division requires to be on deposit is it varies by line. For example, in workers' comp, it's different than it is in other lines. But an insurance company has to annually provide data to the regulator to prove that they are solvent. And then every so many years, each state does an intense review of each company that's domiciled in that state through an audit system. Which is probably the reason you don't see this happen very often, is that the red flags come up and some actions are taken to prevent that. And it's usually in a sale. The company will simply be sold to another insurer.
Representative Nose, the nerves of the library.
So this is very interesting. I had no idea that this existed until now.
I want to work for them.
So I'm going to ask a question that's going to sound kind of stark, but I think it'll help explain for us what this is. Say we didn't have this credit, right? Like, you know, up to about 5 minutes ago, I would have said, sure, let's get rid of it, and we're not using it. Say we don't have this credit, and then this problem presents itself, despite the due diligence of the insurance commissioner, Representative Hayden's insurance company still went under. What do we do?
People get screwed.
I mean, well, those people get screwed, right? I mean, so is that really what happens?
Their claimants get. I mean, there isn't money to pay the tail of claims, and unless there's some alternative way to do it, like taking over the company, those claims don't get paid. So the doctors in the hospitals, or maybe in some cases the patients, end up paying those claims.
Well, okay, so can I follow up on your explanation?
Okay,
so is he explaining it correctly, John?
That's a good question.
Right. Am I explaining it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nose, if you did away with the Guarantee Association statute, that'd be the case. If you just do away with the tax credit, the insurance companies that were competing against the company that was underselling them get screwed.
Wow. Okay, that's this is super interesting. So, I mean, there's a little bit of me that wonders, like, geez, would we be better off just, paying it outright? I mean, I don't know, but I'm wondering about, like, is this the best way to ensure that people who bought a product and then it goes belly up have some security? I mean, it's like reinsurance. It's like insurance for insurance, if I'm understanding correctly.
Well, the bigger law he's putting, the bigger statute requires insurance companies to do that.
Yes.
So, I mean, we've got that protection. We require them to do it, even if they don't get the tax credit to do it. Then they need it. Is that a lot?
So, thank you, Chair. Mr. Powell, so you talked about they're able to spread the whatever the credit would be over 5 years, 20% a year.
Right.
So, within this credit, is it something they can carry forward? So, if the first year they didn't have a tax consequence.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, I don't believe they can carry it forward. The statute's pretty clear that it's over the next 5 years.
It's just over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And as the chair pointed out, if there was a year in which they didn't make enough money to offset, then they can't get that back either.
Thank you.
right. You have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of building off of theirs. I'm still trying to figure out why we approach it in this way as opposed to some kind of outright either reinsurance or upping the amount that is held in that reserve or the state taking it on, because it seems like if your insurance company goes under and I'm standard and I buy it and I don't have a tax liability, it's like you're allowing the ones that make the profit to benefit, but the ones who might be...
No, if you buy the company, that's a different story. That's not what this is
but
about.
So I don't get the
nobody
concept.
Nobody buys it. It's picked up by a pool.
The pool that just takes care of it.
And in exchange for them picking it up, we help them out. We
but only if they're making a profit. So the ones that aren't making a profit don't benefit, even if they've paid.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a big problem. Insurance companies losing money in this state. So
maybe someone can explain it later. I clearly don't understand it. I don't understand who are the ones that are getting every single insurance company out there then.
And Mr. Chair,
who pools their money?
To understand the theory of this is to spread the cost of an insolvency as broadly as possible. One way to do that is through the general fund. Most of us pay into the general fund, so if it came out of that,
I think we really need to move on. We have two more bills to hear.
What this bill does is something similar, because most people buy insurance. So what it does is the companies that sell the policies that are still in business pay the claims of an insolvent company. And then they're able to draw down what they paid out over 5 years in 20% increments to get that back. In essence, they loan the money.
Only if they have a profit.
Yes. Well, they can only take a credit if they have a profit. Mm-hmm. So they in those years when they didn't, they would lose that ability to withdraw that. But, you know, hopefully they would make a profit. And they do. Insurance is one of the largest contributors. It's a big contributor to the general fund.
I'm going to close this hearing. Thank you very much for your explanation. We will hear from the insurance company on this question of solvency. I mean, from the insurance. We will hear from the insurance division on this question of solvency. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2110 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2125. I'm sorry, which one? 2247, I'm sorry. And ask Representative Wilson to join us. Will you explain the bill for us, Madam Administrator?
House Bill 2247 expands the rural health care income tax credit to include pharmacists, services in rural areas, directs the Office of Rural Health to establish certification criteria, and applies to tax years beginning January 1, 2016.
Good afternoon, Michelle Greenlick and members of the committee. Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. Time for a simple little bill on a Friday afternoon, I presume. From what I heard.
Fine.
Nice to
you. To be simple.
No kidding.
Well, nice to be before you today. Essentially, the purpose of the bill is to amend ORS 315.616 to extend rural health care provider tax credit to licensed independent practitioners, specifically pharmacists. It's a pleasure to bring this bill to you today because, the problems that we face in rural Oregon are legendary, and I think this is just another way we can help. The tax credit itself is an incentive for healthcare professionals to locate in rural parts of our state which have been identified as being underserved. Currently, the tax credit is applicable to certain dentists and podiatrists, optometrists, licensed physicians, licensed physician assistants, licensed nurse practitioners, certified registered nurse anesthetists, and optometrists. I believe it's fitting that this incentive be extended to doctors of pharmacy. And the care and the service that these practitioners provide helps to relieve the workload of rural physicians. As Dr. Eric Jones has stated in his testimony, LIPs can prescribe medications, can order lab work, and perform many of the same duties that a physician can. And by extending the rural provider tax credit and encouraging these professionals to locate and work in rural Oregon, patients and providers are better served. Going on, as Dr. Jones has testified, the post-diagnosis work has proved to be a valuable asset at the Grants Pass VA clinic, where each physician has up to 1,200 patients apiece. We're fortunate to have a VA clinic in Grants Pass. It's relatively new. It's serving rural clients, as you know. Their care is improved, we feel, through the addition of pharmacy practitioners to this multidisciplinary healthcare team. And for that reason, I would really urge you to approve this. And I know it's going its way to revenue if you pass it through, and I certainly hope you will. As you know, and as I've previously stated, life is extremely difficult in rural Oregon these days, in many cases with the economy, especially in certain geographical areas, just circling the drain. And so anything like this can really help. So we appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
I understand this wouldn't add any extra money. It would just allow these practitioners to compete in the pool for whatever money there
is. That is what I understand.
Okay. Yeah. So
I did not have an understanding. So I thought anybody that qualifies for the credit can get it.
Yeah.
So is there a pool?
We only allocate $10 million and first come, first serve, and the pharmacists can get in line too? Or is it, it makes me feel differently about it.
We'll hear about that when we bring up the next bill. We'll be talking about that point. That would be the place to ask that question.
Very fine. Thank you.
Mr. Kenny Guy?
I was thinking, Mr. Chair, I was thinking that it's not the pool for the loan repayment fund. It's a tax credit that anyone that qualifies would ostensibly. So they're not competing against nurse practitioners and doctors. Anyone could get a tax credit if they qualify as being in a rural area, I believe. But I'm also wondering, do you know statistics on workforce capacity and the degree to which we lack pharmacists in rural areas?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer. No, I really can't state any specifics there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
We have heard quite a bit of testimony in the past about the problem of pharmacy services. But I'm not sure that the individual practitioner, the kind of pharmacist that the VA uses, that just have to drive 50 miles to get your prescription filled in Eastern Oregon. And that causes a lot of problems. But
just a quick question.
Yes, go for it.
And this is for independent practitioners only. They're not employed pharmacists.
Representative Greenlake and Representative Bueller, as I understand it and the way I'm representing it, it is for a pharmacist specifically in underserved portions of Oregon. In my case, I speak in respect to Southern Oregon, the Rogue Valley, Illinois Valley, and so forth. But I know in the Klamath area this has been an issue as well.
Representative Wilson, thank you very much for coming for this.
Appreciate that.
Employed by Walgreens.
Right.
It's different.
We can find out.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2247 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2125. We have, can you tell us what we have in this bill? We have several witnesses who want to testify.
Yes, we do,
this
Mr. Chair.
This is important.
And this bill,
be brief.
2125, extends the sunset for the rural medical care tax credit till January 1, 2022. This has a sub-referral to the Committee on Tax Credits.
Please call the first panel.
My first one's against it.
Hmm? Oh, we have one opposed.
Right, so let's start with Scott Ekblad and Doug Barber. Do I go down one more?
Sure.
Jack Dempsey.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health.
Probably doesn't matter.
And I will begin by saying that the Rural Practitioner Tax Credit was created by the legislature in 89 and began with the 1990 tax year. It is a credit of up to $5,000 against personal income tax of healthcare providers who practice in rural Oregon. Eligible professions currently are physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, and dentists. It is administered by my office. We receive, and by that I mean we receive the applications, and we determine eligibility and then pass those names along to the Department of Revenue. So while we know we can tell you who is deemed eligible by our office, it's the Department of Revenue that can tell you just how much their credit is worth and whether they actually claimed it on their taxes.
Scott, and the question that was raised before, can you answer? Is there unlimited funds? Does everybody who qualified get?
Correct. If you meet the eligibility criteria, you can claim the credit on your taxes, so it's not a pool of money.
Good.
Eligibility requirements differ from one profession to another, but all must practice in rural Oregon at least half-time. This credit is one of the few tools available to rural communities to attract and retain healthcare professionals. The intent was to increase the number of providers in rural Oregon. And the graph that is exhibited there in my copy of written testimony illustrates that the number of providers in rural Oregon has in fact increased, or at least the number of providers who qualify for this tax credit has increased over the years. However, I want to point out that the real challenge in healthcare workforce is distribution. Sadly, there's still a substantial difference in the availability of providers in rural versus urban. So, for example, there are 3.2 physicians for every 1,000 people in urban areas of Oregon, but only 1.4 per 1,000 in rural. And for nurse practitioners, it's 0.61 in urban, 0.43 in rural. For physician assistants, it's 0.39 per 1,000 in urban and 0.22 per 1,000 in rural. So in 2012, we polled all 2,000-plus recipients of the tax credit to ask just how valuable is this program to them. More than half responded to the survey. Any of you who have done surveys know that's really an incredible response rate. They clearly feel very strongly about this. 86.3% reported that the tax credit was important or very important in their decision to practice, their initial decision to practice in rural Oregon. 94.3% reported that the tax credit is an important or very important factor in the decision to remain in practice in rural Oregon. And this really points out what I'm going to list as my next bullet point. 65.1% felt the credit is more valuable in retention than recruitment of providers. So I've heard some discussion among committee members about the purpose being recruitment of providers to rural Oregon, and I do believe that was the original intent. I think what's happened over the years is that it's really become a more important retention tool than recruitment. 19% felt the opposite, that it was more important recruitment tool than retention, so I think it's a pretty clear majority. When asked if the tax credit was eliminated, how would it impact your decision to continue to practice in rural Oregon? 37% said it would make them consider leaving. 40% said they would either begin looking for other opportunities or would leave immediately or as soon as possible. And then finally, in response to an open-ended question asking for feedback on the tax credit, more than a third responded to that optional open-ended question. The overwhelming majority reiterated the value of the credit in recruiting and or retaining providers, and many mentioned that it also lessens an urban-rural pay differential. Now, I'd be the first to understand the inherent limitations of internal evaluation, and that's exactly what this is. We're the office that administers the program, and so then we turn around and ask them how they like it. And that's why I fully support the recommendation of the Oregon Health Policy Board's Workforce Committee that we support data collection and external evaluation of this program and other incentive programs. The only way we'll be able to make informed decisions is with purposeful, methodologically sound data collection and analysis. In summary, I believe this tax credit, if this tax credit is allowed to sunset, we will lose providers in rural Oregon. I also believe it will be more difficult to recruit new ones. And for that reason, I recommend that you support House Bill 2125, extend it for another 6 years. In the meantime, hopefully Senate Bill 757 will pass. And that bill would enable us to come back to you in the future with solid evidence-based recommendations on how best to ensure an adequate healthcare workforce in Oregon. So I thank you for the opportunity, and as always, I'm happy to answer questions.
Scott? I want to continue with a question I asked before. We have a bill in front of us, or will be in front of us, to deal with adding occupational therapists in rural areas to this. We heard about a bill to ask independent pharmacists. Is there a problem just adding anybody to it, since everybody's going to get it anyway? Somewhere along the line, there's going to be some consequences of that. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, I think it's just a matter of that additional loss of revenue to the state if more people are added.
A trivial issue.
Well, and I would never argue that we don't need an incentive for pharmacists or occupational therapists or psychiatrists, or actually psychiatrists would already qualify, but, you know, clinical social workers.
Right. Yes. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this correctly, as long as these practitioners are located in those areas, they qualify for this tax incentive. What I don't understand is the criteria up front that qualifies them, other than just the fact that they would locate there, where there would be anything that would change in that could have an impact on, after they've been there 5 years or 8 years, their ability to claim the tax credit.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, they do have to be in rural, they do have to practice at least half time, and they do have to keep their practices open to a certain level of Medicare and Medicaid patients.
Thank you.
And then for the individual professions, there are different sets of eligibility criteria.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Sorry to be so persistent and maybe thick on this point, but I asked earlier about the effectiveness of this program. And there's an answer that we get a report, but then you state that you really don't have a systematic way to analyze data to understand the effectiveness of the program. So I'll ask again, do we know the effectiveness of the millions of dollars that we spent on this tax credit program and others?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I think that we have seen an increase in the number of providers in rural Oregon. To that degree, I think the program has been effective. On the other hand, we haven't seen the increase yet that we would like, and we realize that now the program is probably more valuable in keeping people there than actually recruiting them there in the first place. And I would only add that in order to effectively evaluate any program, you first have to know what questions you want answered, and to ask them after the fact means that we probably weren't prepared to gather the data that we need to answer that question. So that's why I think we can kick the can down the road any number of times, but at some point we're going to have to actually enable us to do an effective evaluation to answer your questions.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead.
So what questions are we answering this time before renewal, and what's your performance evaluation criteria?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I'm afraid I can't really answer that question.
So we're going to make the same mistake again?
I would suggest that we don't. I would suggest that...
I would think the argument is we use the same amount of data we use for most of the things we pass, which is not much.
No. This committee will also...
Thank you for that.
Not much.
Representative Kinnegar.
That's right.
Thank you. I have one clarification question that has to do with the bar graph that I saw in my office, and then something about trying to get at what data you do collect. So the 250, the biggest bar of people who claim this was $250,000. And above. Was that a joint income or an individual income?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kinnegar, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that information.
Okay,
we never do get earnings information.
Okay, so that maybe Doug can help me with that.
Chris.
Okay, well, and then second to that was just, you know, I would think in terms of trying to meet policy goals, there would be some kind of broad rubric of we want to make sure that we have at least 75% of the workforce in each of these different categories. So do you collect information about both recruitment and retention by the different professions, by different geographic areas. For instance, you may have 100% workforce development in Hood River, and why are we going and trying to incentivize people? Because, you know, Hood River is a place where it's very attractive. A lot of people go, whereas other places may be at 25%. And if we really want to target our dollars, do you collect that kind of information?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer. In order to answer that question, you'd have to know what the ideal is. What's the ideal right. number of providers in each of those professions for that particular community?
Right.
We don't know the answer to that. We can only track how many people are, in fact, there. This committee will hear bills on not only this incentive program, but others mm-hmm. that are intended to serve very similar purposes. It's my opinion that we need more than just one tool. One tool is not going to correct the problem altogether. Mm-hmm. And I think that a more comprehensive look at all of these incentive programs would be very important, very informative. There is a bill that's been introduced to the legislature, Senate Bill 757, mm-hmm. that would give people who are equipped and who are external to the office that administers it the ability to do such a rigorous evaluation of all these healthcare workforce incentive programs. That's money for the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and the Oregon Center for Nursing to do that sort of analysis.
I think we need to move on. We've got very few minutes left and still several witnesses. Mr. Barber?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. The Rural Health Association, for those of you who don't know, includes the Oregon Medical Association, the Nurses Association, the Hospital Association, Family Physicians, Physician Assistants, the Primary Care Association, Dental Hygienists, as well as hundreds of practitioners in rural Oregon, all here today in support of House Bill 2125. We hear pretty regularly from providers in rural Oregon that this really is the best tool that they have for recruitment and retention. And Scott talked a lot about that. It's hard to know how that gets weighed in terms of recruitment or retention, but it has definitely helped bring people into rural Oregon. And as Scott said, many of the people who are receiving the tax credit have said that they would leave were it not for this tax credit. So we stand strongly in support of it. There was an interim work group that many of us were a part of that looked at this tax credit as well as some of the other healthcare workforce programs, loan repayment, loan forgiveness, and others. And really, the bottom line of that was we need better data and we need evaluation from somebody, which is what spawned Senate Bill 757. Chair Greenlake mentioned that there is a bill that I think will be coming to your committee that looks at combining funds for loan repayment and loan forgiveness. And when we get that bill, we can talk about why we think that might make sense. But those are really different kinds of programs than the tax credit. So with that, I'll stop and let Jack.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon Nurses Association. So just two quick points. First of all, we do support this. As I said, this is one of our main tools to attract rural providers, and we ask that you pass this on and send it on to the Tax Credit Committee. That being said, you know, during the conversation around this in 2013, we heard from legislators, Representative Bueller, your questions about you're asking us to put money into these programs. How do we know if they're working? And we don't have great data on this. So as Doug mentioned, we convened a work group, the Oregon Rural Health Association. I believe I was president at the time. We had legislators involved. And, you know, the bottom line of the work group was we don't have great data. We need data. So the push this session, and I think some other folks are going to talk about it, there's a couple different proposals coming to fund data collection. Mm-hmm. And we think that's important, and we're behind that and want to do that. Yeah. In the meantime, I don't think you should cut off all these programs and wait for that data to come. Our suggestion would be pass this on, continue these programs, let's get the data in, and then next session or whenever, review that. And if you need to open this back up and change it, then you can do it at that time with data in front of you to help you make those decisions. So we are sympathetic to the struggle that you guys are having right now, but we don't want to experiment with these programs and cut them off and see what happens while we're creating the data around this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, just so I understand, and I appreciate what you're saying there, but we could, as a recommendation, if we want to extend it, we wouldn't necessarily have to agree that the sunset could be extended so far. We could put the sunset at a shorter distance to, I guess, encourage that the work be completed and we have the conversation sooner than, because I think the recommendation on this is 2022 or whatever it may be. So we could recommend the sunset not be extended so far. I guess that's just another tactic to try to keep the pressure on.
So, Chair Greenlick and Representative Lively, yes, that's obviously your prerogative. But regardless of where you extend the sunset, right, you know, if you pass legislation to study this, that will be done. And you can, as a legislature, go back in and look at it at any time, regardless of where the sunset's at.
Okay.
Just quick comment. I'm encouraged that there is Senate Bill 757, so at least you know, that's a recognized problem and it's working through the process to solve it. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, but I'm not impressed that as a researcher, my research, you know, unless you want to do something like randomize people to having the tax credit or not, that we're going to have anything better than we have now.
How
has it affected you? It's an interesting question. Not a simple answer.
No, Chair, I'll just add, I think you will get better data than what we have now. You're not going to get, you know, interviews from every provider in the state to tell you where this is, but you will have better demographic data and you will have better data on where folks are, a number of other points that you don't currently have.
Chair Greenlee, one quick comment. We could cut it off to a portion of the state.
That's right. There aren't very many voters in the rural areas.
I was thinking more of the Portland, East Portland region.
I was just going to say, I'm very excited about the Senate bill coming through, too, and I think it's a good idea to keep it going and not leave people hanging when something has been working. We're not sure how well, but I'm very supportive of that idea. I do think that it would be interesting to look at the loan repayment. If there are some people that are incentivized because they have the loan forgiveness program, and they are there. They have a commitment to be out there. You know, maybe because we're trying to maximize state dollars, maybe they're not eligible for that until the end of their commitment for having gotten that loan, because they're out there not having to pay back school loans as opposed to other people where they really need that $5,000. So I think weighing all those things together is really important.
Get that.
I will just comment real quick that is part of that. It's not just looking at the tax credit. It's looking at all the incentive programs.
Thank you.
If I might just add very quick.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have one person signed up in opposition. We'll hear from them, and then we have three of the usual suspects to join us after that.
Tyler McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. McGinnis. Please identify yourself as you begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Tyler McGinnis. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And I'm here today to express my concerns with House Bill 2125, which would extend the sunset for the rural medical provider tax credit. Before you all decide whether or not the sunset for this tax credit should be extended, please consider the following. Oregon has many subsidy programs that you've already heard about this afternoon. There are insurance subsidies and loan forgiveness and repayment programs, both targeted to rural and underserved communities. A recent study by the Oregon Health Policy Board Healthcare Workforce Committee found that resources of financial incentives in this area may be spread unevenly or inefficiently, and I believe that report is in the record. Oregon is one of only two states that use tax credits to solve this problem, the other being Maryland. Second point is that this credit is primarily a reward, not an incentive. There's no analysis showing that without this credit, we would have fewer rural providers. Providers are able to apply for and obtain this credit 3 years retroactively, and anyone receiving a credit retroactively certainly did not need an incentive to move to a rural area. There's no time limit on this credit. Once a doctor has set roots in a community, why should taxpayers continue to subsidize a practice? And the credit is not means tested. A doctor who is not struggling financially, why should they need a tax credit? Third, the problem persists after a quarter century. 25 years after this credit was created, we're still hearing about problems of attracting practitioners into rural areas. This tells us that the credit is not the right tool. Just a quick piece of social math for you all. The $8.5 million a year that this roughly costs the state, that's enough money to put the entire 2018 MD program at OHSU through a year of school. Fourth, the definition for what constitutes rural is inadequate. Few doctors likely work a 20-hour, 40-hour work week, I should say. So the suggestion that committing just 20 hours of work per week to rural practice would make someone a rural provider doesn't make much sense. And this definition is different from how rural is defined in other tax law. Take, for instance, the Rural Emergency Providers Tax Credit. We should be defining the geography of a problem similarly across programs that are aimed at addressing the same issue. Fifth, at $5,000, the credit exempts too much income from taxation. This credit exempts approximately the first $60,000 of taxable income for a single filer, and almost double that for a married couple that both qualify. Because taxable income is about 70% of gross income, that means a rural medical provider earning around $83,000 would pay no income taxes. By comparison, a medical provider can have a taxable income of more than twice the gross income of a working poor household and fully escape taxation. This is a question of misplaced priorities. And the $5,000 credit is about 2.5 times the typical tax liability of the typical Oregonian. Finally, to close with some more positive news, this credit's tale gives you all a chance to find a solution. Any provider who is eligible for this credit before January 1st of 2014 will remain eligible until 2023. So this buys the legislature time to better study this issue of how to ensure an adequate number of medical providers are in Oregon's rural and frontier communities. In closing, this credit is an oversized credit that provides too much financial reward to people who can be extremely well off. And after 25 years, it's failed to solve a problem that it was meant to address. The spending is a misplaced priority. I'd be happy to take any of your questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Widener. Representative Bueller.
Just kind of wanted to get ahead of it here a little bit before the doctors got a hold of you. So from rural Oregon. So.
The Amulet County is rural Oregon. Yeah.
So, yes. Unfortunately, they're getting out to us very quickly, the metropolitan area. My question is, because we do have an issue in rural Oregon, because we have a lot of Medicaid recipients. Oregon has some of the lowest reimbursement rates for Medicaid patients of any other state in the nation. So I'm actually with you on the tax credit. I don't think it gets it there. But because I think we're masking a problem of our reimbursement rates by offering that. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't, if you looking at this, and I'm not sure who has you here or why you're here today, but if we looked at increasing Medicaid reimbursement rates in rural Oregon, because they don't have the volume of patients that you have in a metro area, if that might be a better way to go it so we actually understand our cost.
Did you just say that?
Chair Greenlick,
he's out of order. You can't just do that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Wider, that's certainly an option. I think us at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, our overarching point here today is just to say that this isn't the right tool to solve this problem. We agree that getting medical providers to rural Oregon is a real issue and something that should be fixed, but doing it through a tax credit like this is not the proper tool.
This isn't just because Silverton isn't in a rural area.
That's true.
Representative Bueller.
Actually, may I follow up for...
Very quickly.
Oh, it's actually, now, we are on
we're
time.
We're now adjourned, yes.
You know what? I'm going to let the doctor have you now.
No, I mean, I think you make a very good point with regards to the low reimbursement, and that's something that you didn't all consider in your analysis. But have you looked at other tax credit programs that are much, much larger than this in the state of Oregon for their effectiveness, like the Business Energy Tax Credit Program? And if you haven't, why not?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, in comparison to this tax credit, no, we haven't necessarily compared that particular tax credit to this one.
Why not?
That wasn't something that we were analyzing this credit on its own. in regards to the fact that it's up for sunset.
Follow up?
Briefly.
But why isolate out this when there's so many, there's so much larger?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I agree with you. There's a whole number of tax credits, and these things have to be looked at systematically. We agree that this tax credit should be looked at systematically within the system of other programs like loan repayment forgiveness, programs like that are aimed at achieving the same purpose or the same goal. But I'm not clear what the benefit of comparing them to just any tax credit necessarily would be.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to run a little late and invite three more witnesses to have about a minute and a half each.
A lot of tax credits.
Josh Baylock, Brian Beringer, and John Mullen.
He's brand new to their
last, but definitely not least.
What is this?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Balick, representing the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, also one of the usual suspects. As a member of the work group that actually was looking at these issues during the interim, one of the things that really struck me as we were going through is, one, we did not really have a great deal of information on exactly which incentive programs worked and which ones didn't. And as you know, the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, providers are the key to making long-term sustainability work for the CCOs. The other part of this was that we did notice that, at least when we looked at other states, that a multitude of different programs seemed to be the most effective. So we would ask that as we proceed forward, that we use, that we don't mess with too many of the programs, maybe even look at investing in places where we can, but basically do no harm this legislative session, get the information that we can so that we can actually make the best investment for the future and the long-term sustainability of both the CCOs and Oregon in general.
You could send us a message and answer to Representative Widener's statement, the extent to which the CCOs pay positions at a rate that's the lowest of anybody in the country. It would be
Chair Greenlink, I'm happy to follow up with that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. To be super brief, our association absolutely supports extension of this tax credit for the reasons that have already been mentioned. I do want to touch on the issue of Senate Bill 757 that is coming. And also note, if you haven't had a chance, the report by the Department of Revenue is excellent. And I thought Mr. Alanak made an excellent point in that they can only analyze as much data as available. And I think one of the things that happens in this building is we create the program, and then we go back and we ask for data collection of the program, and we ask that from people that aren't set up necessarily to collect data, and it's the people that administer the program, which the Department of Revenue acknowledges is a problem. So this bill would kick it to external groups that do data collection, that can analyze that data, and can look at all the programs across the board so we can answer some of these questions I think are coming up. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center and Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. As far as the Oregon Law Center is concerned, we're concerned about low-income people, and so we always look at these issues around tax expenditures, about the value to low and moderate-income people, as well as the impact on the budget. For the Human Services Coalition, I just want to point out very quickly that we supported the creation of the first tax expenditure report back in 1990. We support the process where Chris Alanak is the staff person of reviewing. We supported the whole idea of sunsetting tax credits. And I would just point out for newer members that the legislature is much more aware of the effect of tax expenditures and what it has on the other side of the equation, the budget. As far as the bill specifically itself, why we're neutral on this is that we certainly support the whole idea of access, not only in rural areas, but there are portions of urban Oregon where access is an issue. We are not entirely sure that the incentives and tax credits are the right mix, and I think you've heard from many people about studying this idea further. We would be very supportive of that and recommend that as this goes forward to the tax credit committee, we know that they have a really big job of trying to come up with savings where they're giving $14 million to deal with $64 million worth of sunset tax credits. So we just really appreciate the fact that there's been discussion about this today, really good discussion, and I think I want to commend the legislature for doing its job with paying attention to these tax credits.
Thank you. Any questions to this panel? Thank you very much. Mr. Olenek, I really appreciate your hardness. If you could send us any more information, I think it would be helpful. We'd really appreciate it. I close the work session on House Bill 21, I mean the public hearing on House Bill 2125. And we are adjourned. We won't get a chance to talk to you about your issue.